From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. 5 years after the Civic Arena was raised, the Penguins still haven't begun development of the site.
Unfortunately, it continues to sit as a parking lot. We have invested our resources into the infrastructure on the site, but now we really need to see development, and it's in the city's economic interest to see it.
What's holding up the development, and can the development rights be rescinded? Also, a city councilwoman wants an ethics investigation into whether the Peduto administration is using pay to play when it comes to developers. And the Wolf administration might shut down the state prison in Pittsburgh.
Clearly, all due diligence has not been done. If they have not done an economic study, it is time to delay this decision, allow for legislative and public input.
It's The Confluence, our weekly news roundup, after this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 5 years since the Civic Arena was demolished and the Penguins have not begun developing the 28 acres in the Lower Hill District. Why is there seemingly no progress, and should the Penguins maintain the development rights? The Wolf administration plans to close two state prisons, and SCI Pittsburgh is among the five under consideration for shutdown. That's coming up later in the program, but first, Pittsburgh City Councilwoman Darlene Harris is calling for the City Ethics Hearing Board to look into campaign fundraising activities by the Peduto administration. Peduto is seeking a second four-year term. Primary election is in May. Joining us in studio, Rich Lord, reporter from the Post-Gazette. Welcome back, Rich.
Good
Thanks,
to have you
Kevin.
Here.
And Charlie Deitch is editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Charlie, good to see you.
Good to be here, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. Now, to begin with, Darlene Harris is a possible challenger to Mr. Peduto in the mayoral primary, and I think it's fair to say, or is it, not exactly Mr. Peduto's biggest booster on city council. Is that fair?
Really, Mr. Peduto's only major critic on city council right now.
Okay. Now, according to the Tribune Review, Harris told them that her request has no ties to her potential campaign, and, quote, there's been a number of rumors going on about pay to play, end quote. However, the councilwoman did not make her request, Rich Lord, until a day after your story in the Post-Gazette. So, Rich, had you and your colleagues been hearing these rumors? In other words, what led to this story?
We heard over the summer that there was direct evidence that the mayor's chief of staff, Kevin Acklin, who's also the top development official in the city, had made calls to developers asking for campaign contributions. And this wouldn't be anything dramatically unprecedented in the history of city government in Pittsburgh. But it was different in a couple respects from anything I'd seen over 20 years looking at campaigns and how they interact with government. And just to back up a little, Kevin Acklin, the mayor's chief of staff, holds a dual role. He essentially is his right-hand man in City Hall. He's also the top guy in development at the Urban Redevelopment Authority, and this has been common for mayors for decades, that the same guy will hold those two posts.
For instance, Yaron Zober with Mayor Ravenstahl, Tom Cox with Mayor Murphy.
That's right. That's right. So decades, those two roles have been linked. And the URA role puts that person essentially in the middle of discussions about public subsidies, the buying and selling of public land, a lot of interactions with big city developers. So when we learned that Mr. Acklin had definitely made campaign fundraising calls to developers, we thought that was worth a deeper look.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, I want to get your sense. Have you heard any of these rumors that Darlene Harris talked about? I mean, you've covered city politics for years and years as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I directly heard the rumors that Rich heard necessarily, but I think a lot of times pay for play is perception. I think it goes on because, I mean, I think you're able to say it because politicians are always soliciting donations, and a lot of times the bigger donors do business with the city. So a lot of times I just think that it comes down to who's doing the asking. Is it Bill Peduto who says, I'm here for the city, or is it a Luke Ravenstahl or someone like that? So a lot of times I think it's about perception more than the actual act.
We explored this pretty deeply. We made well over 100 phone calls to people who had business before the URA and were Peduto donors. We made a right-to-know request. The Peduto administration provided hundreds of emails in response to that right-to-know request. We asked many, many questions, none of which the Peduto administration dodged. But we continued to believe it was entirely newsworthy that the people Mr. Ackland called had business before the URA, and so that's what we reported.
Now, help me out here. I guess it wouldn't be unusual from the mayor's perspective that his right-hand man, the person who probably understands his vision, his plans better than anybody else, would make fundraising calls on his behalf. But is it to whom those calls were made that is especially where the questions come about?
Exactly. I asked, well, when you guys sat down and tried to divide up all these fundraising calls you needed to make, was there consideration given to maybe keeping folks away from people with whom they do frequent business? Would you want the guy who does public works calling the pavement contractor? Maybe you want him to call somebody who doesn't deal with public works. That wasn't the way they were divided up when the Peduto folks sat down in the end of 2015 and decided how to raise money. They instead went with a different standard, which was who's most comfortable calling whom? Who do you know best? And I didn't think that that was entirely necessarily the best practice.
Charlie, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And sometimes I wonder, again, I think a lot of times they – I don't know if Bill Peduto thought about the fact that someone was going to come back and say, hey, this looks like this could be pay to play, because again, he's Bill Peduto. He's always been the anti-machine guy. He's always been the he's the one who stood up and challenged Ravenstahl in his pay to play back several years ago. So for Bill, it's just like, yeah, maybe it's a similar thing, but you know, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm Bill Peduto.
Okay, so is it Rich, in the sense that they didn't think about this, or they might have thought about it and who they were calling as they were divvying up the calls that should be made, that they wanted to make, and where they just didn't think, oh, the connection. Maybe the chair of the URA board shouldn't be calling developers, even though that might be an area of expertise on his part. Maybe he should be calling somebody else for a campaign contribution.
Yeah, that apparently didn't come into the calculation. I want to make sure that folks understand that all of these calls we made, all of these associations all these emails we reviewed, all these associations we looked at, did not reveal any instance in which somebody said, yeah, I got a good deal from the city because I made this contribution. We did not hear that, see that, or report that. Now, some of the ethics experts we spoke with said that you have to be cognizant of the psychology of this kind of a phone call. If the guy who handles development subsidies for the city calls you and you're a developer and says, can you make a campaign contribution, how do you as that developer feel about that? Do you feel you have a choice? That's kind of the critical question that I think folks need to ask when they sit down and divvy up these fundraising duties.
I mean, wouldn't it be stupid though for a developer to admit, hey, I gave and I got a deal? I mean, you'd be dooming yourself, wouldn't you?
In fact, every developer we reached said they did not remember receiving the call from Mr. Ackland.
Okay. But did they remember contributing?
They did remember that, yeah.
Okay. We're talking about campaign contributions to the Peduto administration, the Peduto campaign. We're discussing that with Rich Lord, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who had a large article in the Sunday Post-Gazette, and Charlie Deitch, editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper, who's covered city politics for many years. If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. A couple more facts we want to get to is that, and you pointed out this very clearly, these calls were made, at least according to Mr. Ackland and confirmed by, I believe, the mayor, they were done during vacation time by Mr. Ackland, correct?
Yes, he took 2 half-days of vacation to make these calls.
And they were not done at City Hall. Even if I'm off today, but I happen to come into the office, I'm going to make these calls, correct?
We have no reason to believe there were any city resources involved in making these calls.
Okay. So let's go back into history a little bit. In talking about a campaign finance reform in the city of Pittsburgh. I want to get both of your impressions on this. 2008, Bill Peduto, city councilman at the time, was going to be running against Luke Ravenstahl, 2009. He introduces some campaign finance reform. So how does this play what Bill Peduto, then councilman, said and his proposal with what Mayor Peduto and his administration doing, you know, several years later?
Certainly in 2008-2009, Bill Peduto set a standard of keeping government and politics separate. And he was the leader of the charge to put caps on the amount which folks could donate to city campaigns, which had previously been unlimited.
Okay. Yeah, he also in that package, he also did away with no bid contracts, which was the cudgel that they used to beat Luke Ravenstahl with. Was he was getting all these contributions from vendors who were getting some of these no bid contracts. I was wondering, Rich, though, in 2013, or back when I think when those were compared, the no bid contracts of Luke Ravenstahl and campaign contributions. During that, and I think you were involved with that investigation as well. Did any of those developers say, "Oh yeah, we gave a donation because we got a no bid contract for garbage cans or something like that"?
In 20 years of making these calls, I've never gotten quite
exactly.
quite that response.
Exactly. So that makes it strange to me. Not strange to me. That makes it just. I think each individual person is going to have to take what they want from this and decide: is it wrong, no matter who does it, or is it right because you might believe in the person who's doing it now.
Okay. In 2015, Dan Gilman, formerly an aide to Councilman Bill Peduto, sponsored an update to the campaign reform. So overall, what is your assessment of the city of Pittsburgh's campaign fundraising ordinance? Is it strong? Is it just average? What's your sense?
It's certainly far more restrictive in terms of who can give how much to whom than state law is. And also than most municipalities have. There are, though, examples throughout the country of stricter laws, including as close as Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think that the Post-Gazette, again, did a story, I think it was last year, about the sort of combined power of Rich Fitzgerald and Bill Peduto using their campaign finance, their money they're raising together to fund PACs to then funnel the money out to their preferred candidates. So there's still an avenue to get more money out into these elections for your favorite candidates, and those kinds of things aren't blocked.
Campaign finance reform tends to focus on how much somebody or a group can give over a certain time period, not so much who can make a phone call on behalf of somebody else, correct?
Although there are examples in which, for instance, Philadelphia does have restrictions. Certain employees of city government can't make fundraising calls at all.
Even
on their free time. And there are also restrictions as to how much vendors in the aggregate can contribute. Here, if you got a law firm with 200 people, they can each contribute $2,700, which would add up to a lot of money. In Philadelphia, there would be a cap on how much that law firm can contribute in total.
Even though they're individuals?
That's right. If they have a city contract, there would be a cap.
Okay. Now, in this article, you went to a lot of sources, including, I believe you put out calls to former Mayor Ravenstahl, but you did talk to former Mayor Murphy, and we talked about, briefly mentioned his former top aide, called deputy mayor at the time, Tom Cox. He also sat on the URA board, I guess chaired the URA board. And Mayor Murphy said, no, he didn't do that. But also he wasn't one to necessarily condemn Mayor Peduto, did he?
No, he did not. Now, he said in his interview that he kept these things separate. Now, I did the same analysis during the Murphy administration, and the developers gave in the Murphy administration, too. So they didn't keep that money out of the campaign coffers. Now, Tom Cox, who was Mayor Murphy's top guy, had a very different personality than Kevin Ackland does. And Tom Murphy said, you know, I probably wouldn't have wanted Tom Cox to make these calls. He was a kind of prickly guy, although obviously a very dedicated public servant. But that certainly he had a different standard.
Charlie?
Yeah, no, I found that interesting. I think one of the things that Mayor Murphy said in Rich's story was that he didn't think that politicians, something to the effect of he didn't think politicians were doing this. It was just kind of a blanket sort of statement, a blanket sort of, you know, and it's again, who knows? It's all a matter of what you interpret the data to be.
I guess the strongest criticism in the story came from, and not unexpectedly, I would say, come from Nonpartisan Common Cause, from Bob Warner. Sum up what he told you, Rich.
Well, Common Cause PA, an advocacy group, good government group, has taken the position that there shouldn't even be an appearance of a potential conflict of interest, and that you open yourself up when you have that guy making those calls to those particular people to creating an appearance. That, and he also spoke to the psychology of that call. The, you know, can the developer really say no when approached in that way by the person with whom they're going to do essentially be negotiating?
In these cases, it's perception is reality. That's the deal. It's you're looking at what happened. You're looking at the facts. You're looking at the numbers. If a voter thinks it's wrong, then it's going to look wrong to them. Perception is reality.
Okay. So as we're running out of time, I want to make a couple key points for people who are just tuning in right now. Rich, what did you find about any? There are these rumors, but also, did you find any violations, any wrongdoing?
I did not find anything that was a legal violation. No, we didn't.
Okay. Now, so what might happen here? Even this publicity that's come, this talk that's come about this, do you think this could lead to an ordinance that might be similar to Philadelphia's that you referenced just a moment or two ago?
I've not seen anything in the reaction that suggests that that's imminent. Darlene Harris, again, Mr. Peduto's critic on council, has said that the Ethics Hearing Board should look at this. In the past, when the Ethics Hearing Board looked at some of Luke Ravenstahl's conduct, it did result in legislation. I don't know whether the council would have an appetite for really beefing up, further beefing up the campaign finance laws here or not.
Charlie, what do you expect out of this council?
Out of this council, I don't expect much of anything. But I think that the mayor himself should step up and lead the charge toward this. Again, he's been beating the drum for years. He's been the biggest critic of this kind of business. And so, I think that he should step up and he should recommend and lead the charge toward tighter restrictions.
All right. So, do we expect, we haven't heard yet from, and this is the newly reconstituted Ethics Hearing Board, any indication that there will be an investigation as requested by Councilwoman Harris?
My colleague Adam Smeltz, who covers City Hall, has not heard that the request has formally been put in by Councilwoman Harris yet. I frankly don't know that that would result in a whole lot. We haven't seen the Ethics Board particularly swing for the fences in past cases.
Charlie, is there any teeth in this Ethics Board?
I don't think so. It's just when Luke Ravenstahl was called before the Ethics Board, it was more of I think he looked at it as more of annoyance than anything else. We have a great series of photos that just shows just a ticked off, annoyed Luke Ravenstahl that he's there to answer these questions about, this kind of stuff. So I don't really think there are any teeth to it at all.
Rich, any follow-ups on your story that you're anticipating at this point?
There are certainly matters we're continuing to look at. We'll ask you to keep an eye on the Post-Gazette for details.
Okay. Rich Lord, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Charlie Deaches, editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Gentlemen, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
The Civic Arena was demolished 5 years ago, but still no development on site. A city councilman wants to know why. That's coming up on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. 10 years ago, the Penguins were given the development rights to the 28 acres surrounding the old Civic Arena as part of a deal, an agreement for them not to move out of town, possibly Kansas City. 5 years ago, the Civic Arena was demolished, and still no development has really taken place. City Councilman Daniel Lavelle wants the solicitor to explore if the city has any recourse, so maybe and maybe even rescind the development rights. Tim Schooley is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Welcome, Tim. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And also in studio is Bob Botter, reporter for the Tribune Review. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. First, a little recap, if we might. What were the requirements placed upon the Penguins by this agreement? Develop 10% of the site per year. Let's start with Tim.
That's a good start. I'm pretty sure it was a 10-year time frame that they were supposed to buy portions of the property every year until they eventually had acquired all of it through the original agreement. Bob, you can probably fill in on that too.
Well, the there were deadlines set, and the first so-called takedown for development, which means the first property that was supposed to be developed, was scheduled for October 2015, and that would have been the U.S. Steel office site. The Penguins have since asked and received and paid for three extensions to that that deadline. The second property, which was the residential piece, was supposed to start in October 2016, and they have since purchased a 6-month extension for that also.
Okay. Now, they got the extensions, so officially they're not in danger of being penalized because of the extensions?
Well, they're paying $12,500 per extension, I believe. That's the figure.
Okay. But isn't that money actually coming from their drawdown account that was set up of $15 million at the beginning of the agreement? So they really paying any money?
Well, it's money that, you know, it's coming out of their coffers one way or the other.
Okay. All right.
They certainly have a deal that makes it easy for them to continue to kind of straddle this along.
Okay. So during City Council's discussion of whether to authorize the solicitor, ask the solicitor to explore options regarding the development rights, Councilwoman Teresa Kale Smith acknowledged that there is a legal agreement in place, but she also mentioned that she had a personal connection.
My family lived where the arena was, and they tore down our home for the arena. So that was about 60 years ago. And now here we go again, and this area is like constantly held hostage over development and work with the arena and the Penguins. I just think in good faith, Pittsburgh loves its Penguins. We are very supportive. I would hope that the Penguins would love Pittsburgh in return and do what's right for that community.
So, gentlemen, when you report on this issue, when you explore into saying, well, keep an eye on what's happening on the old arena site, do you get much public reaction, or do you sense much public reaction of nothing's really happening because it's the Penguins? And as the councilwoman said, yeah, we love the Penguins, especially after winning the Stanley Cup last year. We love the Penguins. Oh, okay. Or is there much public uproar, any public uproar?
I think in the Hill District, there is a lot of frustration. In fact, Councilman Lavelle has expressed that as one of the reasons he's asked for this review. And it has been since 07.
Mm-hmm. Tim?
Well, there's certainly plenty of people who were not happy with the way the arena was torn down originally, who I'm sure are thinking, I told you so, with the fact that we are 5 years down the line and it's still an empty site.
Okay. So help me out here. Remember when the Penguins announced their vision or whatever for that acreage, you know, the mixed use, there'd be retail, there'd be office, there'd be residential components. Has that overall plan, U.S. Steel headquarters aside, has that overall plan changed much? Is it still pretty much what it would have been?
It is pretty much as from what I've heard from the Penguins.
Okay. Tim, you've heard anything else?
There's certainly been no indication that they've brought anything new to the Planning Commission that would suggest a change in any of that plan. That was all approved by the Planning Commission, so it would have gone back if they'd have made any significant changes.
Okay, the word significant. Of course, you alluded briefly to U.S. Steel, the possible headquarters there. What happened there? Why did that fall apart?
I think it was an economic thing. Tim might know that better.
U.S. Steel was had well documented challenges with their business, and that project was announced, and U.S. Steel was announced, and they had cobbled together various sources of state and local support to get that done, but they didn't have a signed lease. So there was nothing legally binding that required U.S. Steel to go forward with that, and lo and behold, the company continued to go through the year, and its business continued to decline, and the CEO of the company has been working with the Carnegie Way, which is this comprehensive cost-cutting program. And he inherited that project from his predecessor, and it really never fit into the way he was pushing the company to go forward. So the writing was on the wall pretty early when there was no indication that there was a signed lease that U.S. Steel was not going to be on that site.
And that was a huge setback for both the Penguins and the city. They were conning and had held that project, that building there.
Because you have this big anchor, this big name exactly. that I don't want to say lends credibility, but it shows that there is some sort of large commitment.
Exactly. You don't get much bigger than U.S. Steel.
We're talking about the development or lack of development on the old Civic Arena site. We're talking with Tim Schooley, reporter for Pittsburgh Business Times, and Bob Botter, reporter for the Tribune Review. If you have a question or comment, tweet us at WESA Confluence. Mayor Peduto told WESA earlier this week that, quote, it's time to put shovels in the ground, end quote, and that when the agreement was set up, as I mentioned earlier, that there was a $15 million fund, an account for the Penguins.
Should they not develop anything, they'd be able to receive the $15 million as well.
Did the public really know about that?
I was on council at the time, and I didn't know about it. It's a drawdown that basically they had been given by previous administrations that basically say that for each parcel they buy, they can just draw it down off of their account. So if we sell them at a market rate $1 million to build an apartment building, they don't actually write a check to the city for $1 million. They just draw it off of their $15 million account.
Looking back, were the Penguins given too much to stay here in the city?
I don't want to say it was too much because I wasn't part of the negotiations and I don't know where the give and take was coming from. However, these development agreements definitely looked at a kick the can down the road and we'll deal with that when it comes. Well, we're dealing with it all right now.
So that last question I asked of the mayor, is it basically too late? Monday morning quarterbacking or whatever, that the Penguins were given too much. Are there any rumblings? Maybe there were when the deal was originally announced, but is that gone by the wayside now, Tim?
I still have that dynamic in mind as I look at all this. It does seem crazy looking back that, I mean, it's always struck me as odd that they would get both an arena and the land that their old arena was on. That seemed like it was pretty generous, but that's a relatively ancient history now, given that happened in the Rendell area, I think, right?
That's right. Yeah. And the one thing that wasn't mentioned in your conversation with the mayor is that fund, what isn't drawn down from that fund, the Penguins, the city would have to pay the Penguins whatever's left in it.
Right. He said that in earlier part of that. I just include that in that sound clip right there. But, yes, I'm glad you clarified that. So the mayor acknowledged that there are hurdles to the development. And including, well, one of the things that is probably be the best thing that would sell to the community in the Hill District, that community, is the affordable housing component of the residential. So it's like, well, the developers and the Penguins might not make as much money off of this as they could be, and so that's what's leading to a lack of development on the residential component. Is that a hurdle, Tim?
It certainly seems to be, since there's nothing there still.
And I've heard that the team wants more subsidy for the affordable housing component there. And the mayor has said that he's not willing to give it because the rest of the city also needs that subsidy. So it's kind of, they're at a standstill, and I don't know that they've worked that out yet.
What's likely to be the first component of any development would see? I mean, what seems to be, okay, if anything's going to move forward, it'll move forward this aspect of the big plan that you gentlemen were talking about a little bit earlier.
It looks to me like it could be what they're calling the Melody Tent site there at Center and Crawford.
And where is that picture? If we can picture where the arena, as a Pittsburgher, we all say, go to where the arena used to be. But that was above the arena?
Yes, at the corner of Center Avenue in Crawford.
Okay, right below the Crawford development.
Right.
Okay. And what might that be?
Housing.
Housing. So housing is still possibly the first component, or is that intended to be the first component?
Well, they intended the U.S. Steel office building to be the first component, but in lieu of another tenant like that or a commercial part of it, it looks to me like they're moving toward the residential, or could be.
Mm-hmm. Tim, is that the logical thing, the residential first, then maybe more commercial later, or what?
Well, the very fact that they have they've chosen a residential developer would suggest to me that it's more likely that that component of the project would happen first. As far as the rest of the project, the challenge will be if you want to draw a big anchor office tenant in there, it's going to be challenging to get somebody in when the rents for new construction are going to be much higher than going into an established building downtown. So that's always been a challenging dynamic to any new office building in and around downtown.
So aren't you just shifting people where they currently are in a particular existing structure to maybe a new structure? I mean, you're not really getting much. Then you're going to have empty office space somewhere else.
That is part of it, but there's different needs for different kinds of companies. People, if we saw this week that SAP was formally announced that they're going to a new building on the North Shore. Well, they're going to be leaving KL Gates Center and a building on the Strip, and that will leave space for somebody else at a lower rate. And it's a fairly tight market. So, yes, that is the case, but the market is relatively strong. It's just a matter of is it strong enough to support big companies who want to pay new construction rents.
Okay. I don't necessarily want to ask you to be prognosticators, but I talked to both the mayor and the county executive, Mr. Fitzgerald, this week. If we will see development at the old arena site during 2017, I got the expression that it was more hope than certainty. As you gentlemen report on this issue, is it that? Is it a reflection of hope rather than, we're getting indications, we're seeing indications from our reporting that something will happen in 17?
Well, that's a tough one. I know that they have an environmental issue up there that they have to deal with on the site of an old gas station that's near that Melody Tent site that I mentioned earlier. But they also...
Was that known? It just hasn't been dealt with?
Yes.
Okay.
They did announce here several weeks ago that they have a minority developer that they're planning to announce sometime soon. So we could, and they have all the infrastructure in place. So they're in position to do that. Now, whether they will or not, I guess is anybody's guess at this point.
Okay. What are you sensing? What do you hear, Tim? Hope, more certainty, more likely. I mean, you can only kick it down the road so far, as the mayor indicated.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to see. I mean, the city is fairly healthy and doing well in terms of overall development. There's tons of money being spent on development in the city. You've seen Oxford Development do four office buildings in the Strip District, probably in a far shorter, probably sit like well after the arena came down. I mean, they finished that project in a few years. So there is demand in the city. It's just who's going to want to be on that site? And I think a major determining factor will be, and they're going to build that cap. They got $20 million from the federal government to cap over Crosstown Boulevard. When that project happens, and I don't know how that's what the time frame of that will be, that project will look very different than it does now because it'll be fully connected with the rest of downtown.
We have just about a minute or so left, and I want to get your sense of, as the SCA, the Sports and Exhibition Authority, which is a city county agency, in your coverage of this story, Are they putting any pressure on the Penguins? At least, is it leaking out whether they're doing it privately or behind closed doors or not?
It's a better question for you, Bob.
Well, I'm seeing
thanks
two
a lot, Tim.
If they are, it seems to be not leaking out.
Right. I have not heard of anybody from the Sports and Exhibition Authority or Stadium Authority talk bad about them, you know, or say we need this now.
But do we even anybody on the board, individuals, whether it's you know the executive director or not, or the board as an official board? Any individual member's been critical of the lack of development that we've heard of?
My sense is the SEA has been involved with working with the team to build out the infrastructure, and they may not see it as their end to chide them about, you know, what private investment they're trying to bring in. And the infrastructure is it completely done? I mean, the cap will be a different component of it.
From what I understand, they made an announcement here last year that the roads were complete. There may be a little piece of road here, street here and there that they need to do, but they have. I know they have the sewer lines, utilities in, and the basic street grid in place.
All righty. Bob Bowders, reporter for the Tribune Review. Tim Schooley's reporter for Pittsburgh Business Times. Thanks, gentlemen, so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The state prison on Pittsburgh's north side could be closed, and as early as the end of June, that's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESN. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The state prison on Pittsburgh's north side opened in 1882. It was known for many, many years as Western Penitentiary. After the state system of prisons was created, it was officially named SCI, State Correctional Institute, Pittsburgh. The Wolf administration announced last week it wanted to close two state prisons and put out a list of five to be considered for shutdown. SCI Pittsburgh is on the list of five. Joining us to discuss this, Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the program, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And also on the phone from Harrisburg is Associated Press reporter Mark Scalfaro. Mark, welcome.
Good afternoon.
If you have a question for Karen or Mark or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. The list of five, Pittsburgh, of course, in Allegheny County, Mercer and Mercer County, Waymart and Wayne County, Frackville and Schuylkill County, and Retreat and Luzerne County. Pennsylvania currently has, I believe, 26 state prisons. Mark and Karen, do we know why these five are on the list for consideration? Let's start with you, Mark.
Well, they were looking for facilities that are expensive to maintain where they can actually get savings from them. They're not going to close the ones that are newer. I think that's been a driving force, and they're also taking into account whether or not the facilities are near other prisons, because then they can transfer staff from the closing facility to some other existing job.
Karen, is that your understanding that age of the facility is a factor?
That's right. Age, also size of the prison. And now when we're talking about age, in the case of Pittsburgh, that's the oldest operating state prison that we have, as you said, you know, dating from the 1880s. And, you know, it's kind of funny. If you look back in the Post-Gazette archives, you can see that state officials have actually been talking about closing this prison for more than 100 years, but it is open.
Okay. The state of Pennsylvania is currently running about a $600 million deficit this fiscal year, a structural deficit much larger. Karen, they put out, I believe, the corrections department put out what the projected savings would be for each of these five, did they not?
That's right. They put out estimates of what they think could be saved each year by closing any of these 2025, it ranges from about $44 million a year to about $82 million a year. Pittsburgh is on the higher end of that potential savings, although they also note that there's complications in transitioning some of the specialized services that they have at that prison.
I wanted to ask you if, Mark, if the fact of savings, will that be the primary consideration or will it be just one of several factors? You alluded to closeness of other prisons as well, but will the overriding factor be cost savings?
Well, I'm not sure until they make a decision what the overriding factor in the decision will be, but I think it was telling that in the news release in which they announced this, they said that Waymart, which is up by Scranton and Pittsburgh, presented some barriers to closing because Waymart is a prison with services for inmates who have severe mental health issues, and SCI Pittsburgh is a facility where they diagnose and classify inmates, and there's housing for people with medical conditions, particularly an oncology unit there. So I think it's I think what they're doing and what they've done probably involves many decisions, including location. You know, what else is around it, and do they offer things that don't exist in other prisons?
So Karen, even though the two that Mark just mentioned are the two are the costliest or the most cost savings, Waymart and SCI Pittsburgh, the fact that they offer specific services that may not be offered or are not offered elsewhere, is that a sort of point in their favor of staying open?
I think that those specialized services of the Department of Corrections, volunteered the information that transitioning those services to other facilities would be, they said, extremely difficult, would cause the DOC to incur significant additional costs. I don't know which ones they're going to choose. I don't know how this will weigh against the difference in projected savings, but I think that it is certainly something that state officials will be taking into consideration as they make this choice.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the Wolf administration's plan to close two state prisons. Five are under consideration, including SCI Pittsburgh. We're discussing this with the Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Karen Langley, and Associated Press reporter Mark Scolforo. So is it a savings, but also is there just not a need for two prisons? Because according to the Wolf administration, that the number of inmates in state prisons has declined by nearly 3,000 over the last 4 years. So is it the fact that the population is declining, so we don't need all these cells, all this cell space, in addition to the costs? And how many prisoners would be affected? What are they saying, Karen?
You're exactly right that the decline in prison population over the last few years is one of the things that's being cited here. It would be a few thousand prisoners who would be affected by the closures, depending, which ones that they pick. But that is the decline in the overall state system population is one of the factors that was cited, along with some new prison beds that are opened up at a facility that's here in the Harrisburg region. So they're saying that they would have places for all the inmates who they need to house.
The numbers that the Corrections Department have put out, these have to be rough estimates, of course, because until they decide which facilities. But
right.
They've said that about 800 staff and about 2,500 inmates will be affected. So, plus or minus however many, but that's the number they have put on it.
Well, the lobbying has already begun to keep individual prisons open. Senator Udicek, whose district includes the SCI retreat, says the decision is being rushed.
This decision is, we're told, being driven by the budget. Well, the budget process runs through June 30. They're telling us that they want to make a decision on the closures by January 26.
That makes no fiscal sense whatsoever. There has not been a public process. There has not been an assessment, we were told today, of the economic impact. That clearly needs to be done.
So is the plan being rushed? Obviously, the governor wants to have a decision on which to in time for his budget message, which he'll deliver February 7th, and the shutdown in time for the new fiscal year. Are you two hearing about the lobbying, and do you think it's being rushed? I mean, this is a pretty much quick decision, whereas a lot of the study done in advance of the announcement. Karen?
We are hearing from elected officials from all of these places where these prisons are. You know, these are jobs that their constituents have, you know, often hundreds of their constituents. And we are hearing calls for more public hearings, more insight into the decision-making process. You know, the administration, when it's asked about the timing here, is saying that in fact, they're giving more information and more of a heads up than the last time that state prisons were closed a few years ago. And so they are saying that this, you know, should be helpful information for people to be able to make their cases for which ones are closed and which stay open.
But do we know even if
the Prison Guards Union has also weighed in there? They have expressed some concerns about the capacity of the prisons, whether or not they could burst at the seams. And if I understood the corrections secretary, he was making a point about the difference between essentially what's considered full capacity and what's considered, you know, operational capacity and what's absolutely, you know, cheek to jowl capacity. And the state, even after these closings, will be somewhere between there. It's not at the, you know, this is the last, this is absolutely how many people we can squeeze in there, but it's also not at, it's lower than that, but it will also be higher than, after these two facilities close, higher than kind of like the design capacity. So, I mean, that's an issue too. The guards have raised.
People in the Pittsburgh area are saying, well, didn't we just do this not too long ago? Didn't we do this with SCI Pittsburgh, Karen? You know, it was closed for a couple years. It was mothballed. So what are you hearing about that?
That's right, and that's the point that you know, folks in Pittsburgh have made to me, that the state you know, mothballed this, you know, meaning got rid of, moved the prisoners elsewhere, but maintained the facility. I think in 2005 and then in 2007, prisoners were returned to it when the prison population at that time was continuing to tick upwards. And so that is one factor that, you know, proponents of keeping it open say, hey, we spent the money to get this back up and going, and having specialized services there for the population that it treats. And I think that it is like a deja vu for some people who were thinking about that time a few years ago.
We have less than 2 minutes for me. I did want to get this question. Did the Department of Corrections give any indication that family members would be considered? In other words, the ease of family members to visit their loved ones who are incarcerated. Mark?
I don't know that they brought that up, that issue up in announcing this. I don't recall that being an issue, and I'll have to pass on that. I just don't know.
Yeah, Karen, I didn't hear it either. Karen, did you hear anything about that factor?
No, you know, they have provided like an email address, for example, and a phone number that they say that families of inmates can reach out to seek additional information. But we were not hearing that, you know, the decision about what to close would be would have that issue factored into it.
1 minute left to both of you quickly. Would you anticipate that this would get delayed? I mean, the end of January is coming upon us so quickly. Do you think there'll be some sort of move to, you know, to slow down the process? Karen, very quickly, please.
So far, not. I mean, I guess it depends maybe what we hear at a Senate hearing a few days beforehand. But so far, there's been no indication of extending the timeline.
Mark, what about you? Are you hearing anything?
Yeah, difficult to predict what'll happen, you know, with groups weighing in and putting pressure on the administration. That certainly could create a dynamic of its own. The one thing I would point out is the governor's budget address will be just like a week afterward, and this is tied into the whole issue, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, about the state's deficit. So, you know, that's, I guess, if you were looking for a reason why they might not delay it, that could be a factor, that this is part of their overall approach to next year's budget. So if they need to book that money,
all right,
then that would be one reason to go ahead with it. But the real answer is who knows? That's a decision for the administration to make.
All righty. Mark Scalfaro is the Associated Press reporter based in Harrisburg. Karen Langley is the Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Quite welcome.
What's ahead? I hope you'll join us next Friday when we carry NPR's coverage of the inauguration ceremonies beginning at 10 a.m. And please join us at 9 a.m. for a special edition of The Confluence. For this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.